Hello and welcome to the Wokus Roundtable podcast. Today we are podcasting on site at the World Fantasy Convention in San Diego. And I have with me today Mark Teppo. Mark, if you could say hi.
Hi, everyone.
And Daryl Gregory. Daryl?
Hi, Mark. Hi, Karen. Hi, everyone. I'm inclusive, Mark.
It's going to be a contentious podcast. I'll
tell you. We'll try to engineer some sort of fight to make this interesting.
It's not going to be interesting? Is that what you're saying?
We always have that danger.
You have to come up with something in order to make it interesting.
Mm-hmm. It's not going to be inherently. You can just do things like, and it'll sound like you're throwing fists.
Oh, stuff. Excellent.
Like Foley artist stuff. So one of the things we thought we might talk about is publishing across different media. Daryl, you've gotten involved in comics, and Mark, you're involved in the sort of massive Mongoliad project that's partway online and now partway on Amazon, and so it's actually going to be a physical book.
Yes.
Now, and so Daryl, how did you actually get into comics or writing for comics?
It started with jealousy. I said to Chris Roberson, "I'm jealous of you." He'd broken into comics
after he got done laughing.
Yeah, and then he said, "Oh, okay." And then he forced my first novel onto Boom Studios, which is a small independent comic book company. And they dug that, and so then they hired me for this book called Dracula Company of Monsters. That was an idea from Kurt Busiek and his outline. And then they hired me to flesh out the outline and write the scripts. So that's how I broke in, and then now I write Planet of the Apes for them. I'm doing some more online Dracula stuff for them right now. And comics is a lot harder to break into than prose because there's no slush pile. It's really built on relationships and who you know, and I'm terrible at that kind of thing. And I was just lucky to know Chris, and he was lucky to like my stuff, and it was... He knew I was a superhero geek, and I'd grown up reading comics, and so that's how I sort of got in. But in the prose world, you can be totally unknown and be sending short stories off to FNSF, and you can get published that way. That's how I got published. That's how I think most people get published.
Yeah, I mean, the tricky thing about comics is that if you're not a known entity, then you being a writer is somewhat useless, right? Because a comic also has the art. And when back in the day when I wanted to write for comics, I ran into this, which was, you needed to have essentially a finished book with art to show.
Right.
And, we're writers for a reason, because we suck at drawing.
Well, and that's the thing that I'm really branching into now is now that I've been working with some artists, we're getting together to say, hey, let's do some sketches and do a proposal with character designs and like what the look of the book would be. And then that becomes the proposal. You need the artwork.
Right.
An editor I won't name at a major comic company told a friend of mine, I don't read. She doesn't read prose. She doesn't read. So she was waiting for finished comics. And I think proposals have to have the art involved. Otherwise, they can't visualize it. So, yeah, you have to become sort of a project manager, putting together a team, especially if you want to do something creator-owned. You put together a team and then present that to them.
Right. And that's one of the interesting things about what both of you guys are doing is that it is a team.
Right.
Effort. I mean, when you write a short story or novel, somebody's, you're alone in a room and you do that. I can't imagine what it must be like going from that expectation to all of a sudden you're sort of herding all the cats.
Well, I'll talk briefly because I've got a really small team and Mark has to organize a lot of cats.
A lot of cats.
So on my side, it's really simple because there's an editor who put together the team for the comics I'm working on. They found the artist. And the editor was doing the coordinating between. So I'm writing the scripts, and then the editor goes over them, and then they hand them to the artist, who starts doing sketches, and we do basic layouts, and then we have a conversation from that point on, and then they finish with the artwork, adding in the colorist and the letterer as you go along. So that's a really pretty compact team, and you can iterate really quickly. You can have these kind of nights where I'm writing something in email. that is talking to both of them, and then the new lettering is going into the digital files on the night that's going to the printer, and they're also sending me pictures of what the change things look like, and you can iterate really quickly, which is another great difference between prose, standard prose fiction, the way publishing works, and comics. But that's kind of a small team. Mark, though, I mean, I don't even know how you do what you're doing. Why don't you tell them what you're doing, Mark?
It's the same sort of thing, except we don't have pictures. No,
you do have artwork that sets the mood, and some illustration.
So we've got there were seven writers on the project initially, and I think we've had a couple more come and go because it's sort of that rotating sort of cast of characters, and then a number of people as we still call them fight choreographers, but it's not really choreography; it's more as fight specialists that we come in and help out with some of the martial stuff.
Why don't we back up, and could you give people the background on The Mongoliad?
Sure. So The Mongoliad is a pulpy adventure novel set in the 13th century, which is basically around the idea that the Mongol invasion... Well, history speaks of the Mongol invasion of Europe as the Mongols coming to the front door and knocking on the door, hanging out on the lawn, and then leaving rather abruptly, and that's the only reason that Europe was saved. And
so Europe is like a grumpy old man saying, "Get off my lawn."
Get off my lawn,
and they actually listen.
And they actually listen, not because they're tired of listening to the grumpy old man, but it's because they realize the grumpy old man's house is actually pretty run down and not worth much, and they have other things to do. No, but what happened was is that the Khan of Khans, Ogedai, died in a hunting accident, and when that happens, to elect a new Khan, they call together a Kuratai, which is sort of a caucus and election process. And if you want to be included and considered, you sort of have to be at that meeting. And a number of the people who were on the Western, who were in Hungary, were like, we want to be in on that. And so that's a lot of reasons why they left. But also some of it was just the sheer distance from home and the fact that Europe didn't look all that interesting. But anyway, so they went back to have the election, and it took several years for it to sort out, and they were infighting, all that stuff. And by that time, a lot of the interest in taking over the West was sort of lost. And they moved on to other things. So the text that you can find that talk about specifically about what happened, it'll say two things. One, Ogedai was a drunkard. And two, he died in a hunting accident. And you can almost see that the air quotes around hunting accident. I mean, you really can. I mean, just it's one of those things where they just, and he died in a hunting accident. And you're like, they're hunters. Well, how do you die in a hunting? How does the Khan of Khans die in a hunting accident? I mean, it's one of the, and that was sort of the spark of things. And we went, well, because of his death created this cascade of events, what if the hunting accident wasn't an accident? And that sort of was our little tweak of history, and then we sort of developed a whole story out from that, and it proceeded to then spiral way out of, not out of control, but just spiral into this huge thing. But the idea was that we wanted to release it serially as sort of an adventure story, you know, chapter every week, and we wanted to do it in a way that was, there were some technology pieces of it, which is we wanted to provide it to people's devices so they could read anywhere and get away from that fact that you had to be at home to read, and also wrap it with some social media stuff and that sort of thing. So that's all a whole nother discussion. But the creative side of it was that we had a team of seven cranking out content on a regular basis, and it was all very much a very collaborative process. I mean, we had the writer's room, and we worked through the ideas, and then we had, you know, the artists who came in and did art. There was a collaborative process with them, you know, and it very much is an exercise in herding cats. Yes.
You both have novels out of your own. Do you find that it helps you spark creativity working in an environment like that, or do you just find, oh, this is taking time away from the novels,
I have problems. I always feel like I have this niggling feeling at all times that I'm working on the wrong project.
Well, that might just be universal.
I know. I'm permanently dissatisfied. As I'm doing a comic, I'm thinking, I really should be working on the novel. When I'm working on the novel, I'm like, man, I got to get that script done. But it does... What I enjoyed about comics, learning about comics, was learning how to write in that new form at a different pace with a different set of skills and working collaboratively, where a lot of the emotional work is being done by the artist. It's, you know, a lot of the world building is being done by the artist. Like in Planet of the Apes, we've got this fabulous artist named Carlos Magno, who I will specify maybe what's going on inside a room. And when I get the finished pencils, he's added all the stuff in the background that tells you all this stuff about the world, and he's just carrying so much of the weight. So that is really fun, and it is kind of a relief knowing that I'm not alone in this. I'm not alone in the project. But on the other hand, I mean, what I really like about novels is that I am totally alone. It's all, you know, I've got to do everything on the page, and that's really... They can be really satisfying when it works and really frustrating when it's not happening. I have no one to hand it off to and no one to blame.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of it is a very different thing. You know, I think writing, there is a satisfaction in writing a novel because you have the ultimate control and it's going to be your story and it's going to go the way you had planned, and that's a lot of what we as writers like to do. However. The creative energy that comes out of the writer's room is nothing like writing at home by yourself. I mean, whenever you get more than a couple writers in any location, more than a couple creators in any location, everything goes off in different directions because everybody brings their own perception and their own history and their own ideas to it, which to me makes it much more exciting because you really have no idea what's going to happen. And I am shallow enough of a writer that I like not knowing what's going to
happen. And as a person, don't cut yourself short.
Yeah, sure. No, but I like not knowing what's going to happen because I know that that's going to lend an immediacy to the writing that I don't have to be a good enough writer to you know, it's not... I mean, essentially, I like not knowing because I think it translates to the page. And that, I think, generates some energy to things. And of course, it's the sort of books that I write. I write things that are not as meditative on the state of existence, like, you know,
they go kick ass.
Right. And I mean, they have emotion to them. And I think that part of that emotion comes out of that sort of sense of discovery. And when you start adding more people to the mix, that sense of discovery is just constant. It's also, and it really, you learn quickly never to not. You learn quickly not to have darlings as far as ideas go. You know, we had the entire second season plotted, not the entire, we had a fairly solid storyline for the second season that was fairly well plotted out that we had to just throw away because an idea was brought into the room that made the whole thing made the whole thing turn a different direction. And all of that stuff we had thought and planned for as a possible storyline for season two is just now garbage because that's not where we were going to go. And I know it's probably there; it's all written down somewhere. But you know, you have that you have literally, you know, 5-10 minutes of going, oh, that's my favorite idea, and then you're like, but off we go.
Well, and I love it. I love it even when in the collaborative process where even like small things like I was writing a script for Apes. And I just said, and there's like these two burly henchmen guys in the background. And Carlos, the artist, made one of them. So we're in this post-apocalyptic kind of future, about 600 years after nuclear war, before Charlton Heston arrives on the planet 1,300 years later. So it's very kind of Mad Max looking. And I have, so for the two burly guys, Carlos drew one of them as like... a white guy who was dressed like the Indian from
the Village People.
Right. And then another guy, he'd given him goggles and a leather cap and a monkey, a little like a macaque. And I was like, I was in love with these guys. And so from that point on, they're in almost every scene I can fit them in, including the monkey. And then we've named them, and now they're getting like starring roles. Like they get, I just gave one of them, not to give anything away, a really heroic death because I love this guy, and so I had to kill him.
Sure.
But it was like it's like those kind of little accidents of creativity. You just see something in the background, and the other thing that we have in common with these two projects that's different from writing novels is the fact that it's serial fiction.
Right.
And you get the built-in surprises of, you know, you have sort of a general plan, at least in the way I'm working, a sort of general plan of where I want to end up for each arc or for the end of the year. But there's a lot of fuzzy middle going on. Now, when you're writing a novel, if you come up with some new idea, you can go back and start over and go, you know, load stuff back into the first chapter. In serial fiction, those are already out on, you know, people have already read them. They're committed. So you're sort of, you know, held at gunpoint or being, you know, painting yourself into a corner or some other metaphor that better says what I'm trying to say. Where
strapped to the rails.
You're strapped to the rails, and you have to come up with something that follows from that other from those initial premises. And it can be a lot of fun, because every time you sit down for that next installment and go, all right, we continue the story, and then can you strap on your writer guns and go to
and
town?
Go. Yeah, no, I think that's and writing to a serial format is much different. I mean, the pacing is different in your head. I mean,
I feel like Charles Dickens more. I feel like, okay, you know, next installment.
Next installment, yeah. And you know, it used to be in the beginning, we had longer chapters in the beginning than we are doing now. And part of that is because we've had a sense of what the readers like, how much content the readers like to see in a given week, and other sorts of aspects. But now I find myself. You know, the writers may have sent in, you know, 10,000 words, and I may find myself going through it that somewhere around 7,000 words is the end of that installment, and that we have to then move that to the next, because that's the place to leave.
That's the
emotional ding, and you're like, you know, saw it off here, and then you got to figure out how to put that in the next bit, you know, that last bit in the next part. But that's different thinking than with a book, right? Because you don't have these tight loops, you know. But you also got to have that, like you said, you want to know the plan for the arc, right? And you're going to be working towards that.
And it's this real balancing act between you want to pay things off for the reader at a certain point, like pay off that story arc, but still leave room for surprise, but not do like what could happen, let's say, in Twin Peaks or some serial television. Let's say I didn't really watch Lost after the first season, but let's take Lost for example. If the reader gets the feeling that you are just making it up as you went along, that there is no planning, that you're just improvising and tap dancing as fast as you can, then they start to lose patience. So there's some sort of mix of saying, look, I promise you that these promises that are made in the early chapters are going to pay off down the road. If you don't pay them off, if you just hope that people forget about them because you follow some other new route, I think they get frustrated. Or at least I do.
Right. Well, there's a certain amount of you in the early. I mean, then I think the writers of Lost have even said as much, is that they were throwing everything they could think of in the mix to see what was interesting to people, right, and where things went. And you know, there's a certain amount of that, but that is the danger with serial fiction and the attention that can be focused on a product by your audience, is that you can't leave those danglers and just say no one will remember them. No one will remember the polar bear.
Right.
and you know, they do. Everyone does.
Where the hell the polar bears come from?
No, I think that the second season of Lost, I think some of the most interesting recently, the second season is some of the most interesting narrative on TV. And some of it is lost because some of it, you don't get the same sense of it now because you can see it on DVD. But they had a huge drop-off in audience during that second season. And when you watch those first 8 episodes or so, which essentially is the next 15 minutes from 8 people's point of view, nothing happens, quote-unquote. But it is some really spectacular, tight writing. And if you watch them all back to back, you can't watch it fast enough. But if you have to wait a week between each one of those, and you go, "Oh, look, nothing happens again," you know, well, it would just be, you're like, "Where's the payoff?"
That's something that interests me too. Yeah. Is like I don't know how you guys handle this, the mental space between episodes.
Yeah.
So writing monthly comics, you know, it's so different. Like writing novels, you just sort of assume a contiguous reading experience. Even if it does, even in the real world, it gets broken up. You can assume that if you reference something in this chapter, it'll be recent enough for them to remember it. And the same with pacing. So, but with the monthly comics, I'm writing them for two different audiences reading two different ways. One is the monthly reader, mm-hmm. And one is the person who's picking it up in trade, the collection. And those are two different reading experiences. And I find myself wondering how this is playing. Like, I was thinking of this, was it 2 years ago when Watchmen the movie came out? I let my teenage son, read Watchmen in collection. And his experience, I think, was really different from my experience reading Watchmen as a monthly comic. Because in between the issues, we were talking about it a lot. Because you knew you were reading something great, and we were constantly wondering about what's going on, and we're talking about it. So the actual storytelling mass of The Watchmen was much greater. It had a virtual mass much bigger than what was on the page because of all the stuff that was going on in our heads
right.
in between while you're thinking about it and drawing those connections. And so if people are thinking about it like the way we were constantly thinking about Twin Peaks in that first season. Then it has this great effect when you're in spacing it out. But it sounds like you could also run the other way where if you don't progress fast enough, people just lose interest.
Did he read the text bit? Did you know if he read the text bits or did he just read the art bits in the collection?
How do you mean the readers?
No, for your son. When he read The Watchmen, did he read the little text bits that?
The extra text stuff?
Yeah.
Yes, he did.
Okay, because I'm wondering, is if you had a month, you would actually tackle that stuff versus
You know what? Yeah, I wonder if he was tempted to skip because it. Yeah, we were pouring over that extra text stuff in Watchmen to get extra clues to find out what was going on.
We have four storylines, and we were publishing once a week, and so what we discovered was that it would be a month before you got back to the storyline. And that was way too long, and because people just couldn't remember. And so, if you look at the early stages, it's A B C D A B C D A B C D, and then somewhere around, I think chapter 25 or so, we finished off the Rome branch. We just ding 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 and ran the rest of them in succession, and we're done with it because the. One, we had it in the can, and two, it didn't intersect with the other branches in a way, and we wanted to get past that. Oh my God, I have to wait a month till I get.
Now, did you know that from feedback from the readers? Like, that's the other thing that's different in serial stuff is that you can actually get feedback while you're writing it. Like Dickens getting letters saying, don't kill off.
Yeah,
little Nell.
That was some of the commentary that we've been getting was that just that. Oh, I don't remember what was going on, and so we're like, okay, we couldn't increase the. We couldn't increase the frequency of content, but we're like, we need to figure out if I get one of those chapters where I'm cutting it off at 7,000 words and there's another 3,000, that's going to be my next week is going to be the rest of that because that may be too much of a cliffhanger to hold them for a month. Because the Rome branch was getting to a point where things were falling fairly quickly, that sort of ding, ding, ding. It was lots of talking heads and events were coming fairly rapidly and having people remember all the details enough to really follow it over a month was just, we were like, no, it's not going to work. And so we finished that off.
Now, when you did the printed book, did you reorganize by main story then?
So the printed book has its own, now that we're going back and putting it together for print, which is going to be three volumes, I have to rethink of it as a novel and not as a serial. And I have to think of it in the sense of, the books have to have their own arc,
mm-hmm.
so that they are a satisfying reading experience as much as I can, because. So I have to have so there was a lot of sitting down looking at the content and trying to figure out good spots and charting, where I've got tension and where there's, that sort of thing, that so I get those sort of peaks and valleys that. You sort of don't worry about because you've got that sort of churn of things. Like the Rome branch doesn't show up until book two.
Oh, okay.
Because it comes along at a point, and then of course this is generally given as you just start restructuring things all together because it's a whole bunch of more characters we're introducing, right? And it happens in the timeline late enough as well. That we can get everything rolling and going on to a certain point and that has its own sort of shape and arc. Mm-hmm. And then when you pick up the next one, you're going to get some new characters, and there's going to be, it's essentially we're growing the world a bit, because that's a good time to do that versus trying to cram a whole bunch of things that barely get started and then the book's over. So that's shuffling around of things, and it's gonna be a different reading experience because of the nature of how people are gonna be reading it. Yeah, things you don't ever plan
for. And does that require a lot of time? I mean, how much work is that to restructure? Because you're doing these on at a pretty quick pace, right, for Amazon?
Yeah. So their first one comes out in April, and I think the plan is every 3 months. So midsummer and then fall. So, you know, boom, boom, boom. And then we're also shortening the chunks as well, right? So, like, I think the first chapter online is like 15,000 words. And that's a pretty long intro. And because, you know, that we wanted to get them, we wanted to hook them, but of course there was some setup before the hook. And so then that is going to be broken up a bit into smaller pieces, and some other things are going to be anyway. So yeah. So suddenly I'm having to rethink things.
Well, I know in comics, when people are talking about digital, like our web comics, there's always this conversation about what is the pace even of publication. There's a lot of debate whether, you know, should you do a daily comic that you stop back for every day and you get one page. Do you batch it up like Warren Ellis's great science fiction webcomic, Freak Angels? You come back every Friday and there's five more pages. So the online comic I'm doing right now, they're sort of doing, you know, an initial batch of 11 to get you hooked and then releasing chunks of pages. So they're having it both ways. They have a chunk of 11 for the first week, and then they're going to be doing a daily sort of batch of pages. So I don't think people understand enough about – I think it's fluid enough, and maybe it totally depends on the type of story it is, about what is the rate of people coming back, you know.
Right, and there's also the rate of consumption. Is that and there was this argument when we started that people were really honest about a week was too long to wait between installments. And, of course, they're all going to get on my case. They're all going to come back and tell me that we've slipped from that. But in the beginning, there were a number of conversations in the forums about a week as being too long. And I finally had to go out there and say, look, I get it. I'm sorry, but we need to establish a schedule that is a regular, so that is right. So you don't have to go, oh, is there something new out? It's, oh, it's Wednesday. There's something new, right? And that becomes the rate at which.
Well, you also don't want to risk burnout. Some webcomics that I started out really enjoying, and the author artist would be really enthusiastic, and oh yeah, they'd be hitting their schedule like Monday, Wednesday, Friday, or whatever. And then at some point they'd get burned out. They'd trip. They'd miss a week. And then they kind of lost momentum and they miss more.
I think people have been burned so often with that. I had the same feeling with some comics I was following. And yet what you want, as well as the quality, is you want them to show up, you know,
right.
up and do the job. And
totally
so you can trust them.
If you have to back off from Monday, Wednesday, Friday and be only Wednesday, if you need that time, okay, I'm happy to give that to you, but then you need to show up every Wednesday.
Right, this last year's been a learning experience across the board in so many ways. But yeah, and that, because that is the other problem is that you run into of how much breathing room do you have, right? And we totally blew through our breathing space to a point where it was just, you know, Tuesday night at 11:55. You know, I'm frantically putting, you know, the last of the corrections in so that I can turn it on at midnight, you know, so that it's there. And, you know, I got to a point where I hated Tuesday nights because I was like, oh crap, here comes the crunch. Every Tuesday. And I was just like, it's almost like every Tuesday I have another novel deadline. It was just, it wasn't that big, but it was just the constant sort of, you know, and then I'd relax on Monday, you know, and Wednesday is the worst day because you make the crunch and then you get moving on the next thing, then the weekend happens, which fucks your schedule, and then Monday rolls around and you are really behind, and it's just like, God, this is the worst Wednesday's the worst day to release stuff because it's just there's that hole right about the point where you need to be getting things done, and it was like yeah. So,
are you going to switch release dates for this going forward? I mean, are you going to not do Tuesdays or Wednesdays, like the switch days?
Honestly, right now it's literally it goes up 5 minutes after it gets done. And I go out and beg forgiveness and tell everybody it's there, and then go back to the hole and crank on the, and we crank on the next bit, and when it's done it goes up and we're just not even worrying about hitting that Wednesday anymore because it just the management of the expectations and all that stuff has become it's its own.
But
time,
maybe you need to declare amnesty for 2 weeks, and then to get back on the schedule.
At this point, we are on the back slope of being finished.
Oh, so you just got to get it.
We're just gonna plow through to the end and
yeah. I like how I have opinions on how you should do this, having no experience whatsoever.
No, but I mean it was an experiment. We learned a lot about how to do serials online and how to tell stories and what people and what works with a collaborative group, you know. And you know, we're gonna apply those in the next season. I think we're gonna do. We're not going to do the four story arcs sort of thing. We're going to have smaller arcs that is going to be the narrative you have, right? And that's why we've been talking about the idea of having novellas or novella length material that is shaped like shorter self-contained arcs that are more like comics, right? It's like the 4-issue arc. You know, and then you have a bunch of those, and that happens to fill out the trade, if you will, the 12-issue, the 24-issue thing. And that's the story you're telling, but you're doing it in these smaller chunks that wrap off, and then that's what you're giving the audience in a time frame that they all feel like they can follow the story. There's not that, oh, which branch are we doing this week, and that sort of thing. And
I noticed I had to do a mental switch for writing serially about the rewriting process. So in short stories especially, but novels too, but especially it's clear to me in short stories how often I've rewritten short stories to try to get them to work. Like, you know, and it'll take me several drafts maybe to find the right way to tell the story. And what I found with comics is my chance to rewrite is not on the current issue. My chance to rewrite is to take any lessons I've learned and apply it to the next issue.
Yeah.
In some ways, I feel kind of dirty because I think, oh man, you know what? If I had just been a better writer when I first started doing those first comics, I would go back now and do them differently. But it's like you have to just keep rolling, and so there's a certain freedom in that.
Yeah.
But I still appreciate that. This is why I don't want to stop writing, regularly published kind of prose, because I like doing it both ways. Like I'm not ready to give one up yet. I like the freedom of just rolling through the serial stuff, but I also like the craft part, saying, can I make this story work and then and put it out there as a finished guy that I right. could, you know, stand by.
Right, and that is, I mean, I think more and more, the idea of something being finished, I mean, there was in the software world, there's the idea of something being good enough, that it's good enough to release, and then you iterate. And I had a real hard time with this when we first started doing things, because I'm like, that is not the way novelists work.
Yeah.
When it's done, we release, and we can't iterate. I mean, you don't get a chance to go back through and, oh, I want to rewrite that or fix those sorts of things. And that's we have that ability because it's an online serial. We can go back and ninja edit things and fix things and make corrections and so on and so forth. I think we've had to do like 3 or 4 that were just gaffes that we needed to own up to and go fix. But there is that sense of we polish something and then we're done with it. And I think you're right. It's that rolling sense of I think the serials are short. I mean, it's the same sense of I don't think that sense of rewriting something and polishing something goes away with serials, because it's also true for books. You always think, oh, if I had a chance to go back and rework that book, I could make it better.
Yeah.
But I'm going to apply what I learned to my next book.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's the same mindset. You're still applying what you learned to the next project, and you're trying not to look backwards. You're just trying to move forward. But the serial stuff in the comic book is such a smaller chunk, and it comes so much more rapidly
right.
that, you know, you're just, I'm learning. I'm learning, and I'm moving forward, you know. And, yeah, I mean, I think that's the lovely thing about all this is that there are opportunities to learn and move forward much more quickly.
Yeah, in software development, my day job is a programmer, and you want to fail early and fail often. you want to get early failures, and then you want to correct for them, and you want to have the opportunity to fail. Like old style development was more of a novel writing kind of thing, where it was. We're going to have everything perfect, and we're going to ship it on this date. It's going to be pressed to CD, and then it goes off. Well, especially in web development, it's more like, no, we're going to do iterations, and we're going to push out a release every quarter, and features will come in as they get done. We're not going to make, the perfect is the enemy of the good. So we're not going to try to fine-tune everything in the application. And I struggle with that all the time, like switching mindsets between, because I don't know, one of my fears when I first started writing comics was, can I write these fast enough? Like my secret weapon has always been that I'm secretly spending way more hours than anybody should, and then hiding that fact from other people so I could seem smarter. You know, because I'm a slow writer, so my only solution a lot of times was to throw hours at things.
Right.
And so I've had to learn. One thing I really liked about the faster schedule of writing comics is I've had to teach myself new tricks of writing differently than I've had to write before. So, like, for example, one thing I've started doing is I write whatever thing is vivid at that moment. And I hop all over the place in an issue. I don't write from... When I tend to write prose, I tend to write from the first chapter, first sentence, and go onward from there, building up each sentence and rewriting even the first three pages a bunch of times till I get to page four and then going over it. It's really tedious. It bores me even to talk about it. But in comics, it's like, look, I don't have time for this. I'm going to go jump to scene number four, scene number three. I'm just going to go wherever I can and build it up. I even write iteratively now where I'm writing combinations. Sometimes I'm writing descriptions of panels. Sometimes I'm just writing all the dialogue for an entire scene and then trying to break it up into panels. I'm just trying desperately to do it any way I can do to get it done faster. And I want to know, from you working on this project, has your writing changed, Mark? I mean, the way you actually write changed? Or when you go back to novels, do you go back to the way you write novels?
It hasn't changed all that much. I mean, it's still, even though it's a serial, it's still a novel, mm-hmm. right? So in that sense, it's still that same sort of thing. It has its own different pace, right? But I'm also a guy who sits down and starts. I guess one of the things that I don't have the luxury of is that I've now gotten to a point where I realize the first draft will suck, and I'm okay with that. But I've got to finish it, and I don't let myself get distracted by those first three pages or the fact the first chapter doesn't work, or whatever. I finish it because I'm no longer afraid of editing it. And I know that I really don't know the shape of the book until I've finished that first draft.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't worry about that sort of stuff. And so in that sense, so that process of sitting down and just doing, going on what's next until it's done hasn't changed. But I definitely don't have the luxury of meandering around and trying to find the shape of things because there isn't that editing rewrite time
mm-hmm.
With the serial. By the time I get to the end, the beginning's already out.
Right.
And so we sort of have to be more on target immediately. But it's still, I mean, they're still jumping around. I mean, there's three storylines we're still finishing and, you know, when we finish a chapter, the next chapter is a different storyline, and so there's a whole set of gear shifting. I mean, it's a whole different cast of characters and different location, and where do we leave them? And Right. So there's this massive brain dump every week of just, okay, that's out. Bring in these guys. Where were we? You know, and
you know, I'd really like, it's too bad, we should bring in, you know Ted Kuzmanka?
Yeah.
Yeah, so Ted, you know, he's got a day job writing for Valve Games, plus he's writing novels. Mm-hmm. I've only written a little bit for games, and it never got published. Their organization sort of fell apart. They paid me, but they never used the stuff I wrote. And I'm curious about, because that's another type of storytelling, the kind of branching storytelling, that I'm really curious to see how people manage that kind of thing.
Well, and Valve does things very differently,
yeah,
than anywhere else. So they, yeah, and that's
talk. Can you talk about that?
Well, what little I've seen, a couple times I've gone over there and in talking to Ted, but it's very much a bunch of people in a room, and something comes out, and the people's roles in that room shifts based on the time of the week and all those sorts of things. It's an amazing sort of creative pool over there, and how they do things is very different than I think they're anywhere else. But it works. It works for them. But I think it is very, very much find the creative spark, and everybody sort of grab onto it and chase it through to its end. And you, the person ahead of you and the person behind you along that chain will change at any given point. So yeah, it sounds completely insane, but they do great work. So yeah.
Yeah, I love their stuff. So So Kieran, make a note. Ted Kuzmanka, he's got a new novel coming out sometime next year.
Yeah.
And a great short story writer too, and a really cool day job.
But writing for games is a different, you know, that's a different mindset again. I think it's a lot of what the we were talking about this earlier, that I think that we're getting into this age where the different media types are realizing that content, good content sells, and they're trying to find people who can make good content, which happens to be writers. And so writers being able to write comics, being able to write four games, being able to write four movies, and for, you know, for web serials, having those toolkits is becoming a good thing, but it is a different way of doing things. You know, I remember when I wrote a couple of screenplays back in the day, and the first one I wrote, my job was, has to be 90 pages, 5 characters, 3 locations, because that's all we can afford in the budget.
Right.
And, you know, the first one, first draft I turned in was like 120 pages, because I kept writing like a novelist, right? And I got down to a point where it'd be like, scene, room, 2 people enter, Sally and Bob.
1 man leaves.
Yeah, pretty much Sally and Bob, 3 pages of dialogue, you know? And that was it, because that's all I had space for, right? There was none of the, I'm going to write beautiful sentences, I'm going to describe the room. It was like, no, it's a room. There's a bed. 2 people talking. And then you realize you can't do novel things of telling what's going on. It all has to be done through the dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And suddenly it's like, this is a different tool set. There's none of the tricks I don't have any of those tricks of writing what's going on.
Right, you can't do things like set tone and atmosphere with description.
Right, I can't have an aside that says, you know, you can see that Sally's really distraught by what Bob is saying. It has to just all come out and you know, it's a different tool set. You know, it really is. And when you're doing comics, you know, you have to think about those things of, this is going to be a full page splash.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, which page is that in the issue? Am I writing to that? Right.
Right. And I may have mentioned this in the other podcast, but I was talking about how it was really a change for me to think about the physical act of reading.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you also mentioned you had to remember whether or not you were at the end of a page that was a middle page or the end of a page that was a page turn.
Right. Because if I want to do a surprise, it needs to happen on a page turn.
Page turn.
Like if I want to like, and the guy appears. But the crazy thing about this is that more and more people are reading digitally. So all these things I'm doing have no relevance whatsoever. You know, like what is a 2-page spread on an iPad is pretty useless. There's no text you can show.
Oh, yeah.
So because it just automatically shrinks down. So, or there's panning, and that's a whole different reading experience as well. Scott McCloud, in his great book that, that every writer of any form and genre should read, Understanding Comics, I mean, talks about, you know, what's happening even, you know, at the physical and cognitive level when you're scanning from left to right, how time is perceived. And he was wondering at the time when he first wrote the book, it was the early days of the web and web comics were coming out, and he was imagining all these variations on forms, on a way of moving through the page. Like you could scroll everything, a continuous scroll to the right, you know. Unfortunately, a lot of that dream has not happened because there are so many different devices. And as a web developer, you're really conscious of this, saying a lot of times your options become more restrained on the web because they could be reading it on a smartphone where the screen is tiny, or they could be reading it on an iPad, or they, you know, so now you're sort of saying, what is the kind of form where that I can either transform on the fly really easily to what the device is, or will work across the broadest range of devices? And yeah, so you're, you know, in some ways the promise has not been realized yet for how online reading could be different, and maybe gaming is probably the biggest difference in how stories can be told in a different way than even what you're doing, because you're mostly doing straight ahead old fashioned storytelling in prose,
right?
Just deliver, it's the content delivery,
right? Yeah, and that's the thing you run into with games is. Because it is so expensive to create content in a game, you don't want to. And they're getting better about this, but for the many years it was like you had every single bit of narrative, you couldn't avoid it, right? And there was no way you were, especially the things that were sort of semi-branching and semi-choose your own adventure. At the end of the day, they really weren't, because they wouldn't dare have a branch that you might not go down, because why would they bother building all that and spending the time and money to build that half hour of the game that you might never see, you know? And that's changed. I mean, they're starting to see that people will actually play things again in order to find all the branches.
Oh, my son certainly does that.
Yeah. And so they're like, it's okay. If we're going to get, you know, 80 hours out of them because they're playing it twice versus 40 hours out of them, that's still okay. So it's still justified. But, and so they're starting to, and then of course, as soon as you start doing that, and as soon as the narrative becomes sort of, you make the narrative yourself, you know, you look at how much writing has to go into to do all those branches. You know, you look at the Mass Effect games and just the amount of narrative of all those little conversation branches that go on, and you're just like,
oh yeah, the amount of text, for instance, my son plays the Fallout games.
Yeah.
I mean, the amount of dialogue between any number of characters you can run into at any point is just stunning.
Yeah. Yeah. No, they have these, the guides to, like the Guide to Fallout New Vegas is this hardback thing that's like 300 pages long, or 300 pages, and it's printed on, you know, telephone paper, such so that they can get, and every single page has got like 9-point text that's filled, and then you're just looking through, and you're just like, this is that world. I mean, we're going to create every single corner of this universe and populate it with stuff that you may or may not ever go see, but it has to be there. And you know, it's like writing 6 novels.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, this becomes this sprawl of content. Yeah.
But I am, you know, I was reading in the New Yorker, they did a profile of, and I'm blocking on his name. He's a Pixar director who did Finding Nemo and WALL-E, and now he's doing John Carter of Mars. I wish I could remember his name.
I know the guy you're talking about. I can.
Yeah, we could. Yeah, we should later edit it in. Of course, it's John Smith. But he was talking about how, oh, you know, that opening of WALL-E that everybody loves, that whole silent beginning. You know, he goes, that just sort of fell into our laps. And the writer points out, it took them 6 months of storyboarding to get every moment of that, you know, exactly the way they wanted. And they have, you know, and their whole approach at Pixar was to critique everything and storyboard everything and reshoot if necessary. And he was sort of appalled in live action that he's like, you may miss it the first time, so of course you need to reshoot. And Disney was like, you don't reshoot live stuff. That's way too expensive. So there's this constant struggle between wanting to, you know, get it out the door versus craft something. And
right.
I think that's the thing I struggle with.
Are we crafters or shovers?
Yeah, I know, shoveling. And you want to get better so that your shoveling is more artful and
more
artful.
Artful, yes.
I shovel well, Marion. Shovel very well.
Shovel well.
On that note, we should probably wrap it up here. I know, Daryl, you've got a launch party.
That's right.
Coming up, which segues nicely into our traditional closing, which is, what have you guys got to advertise for us to, what have you guys got coming out? So, Daryl.
Yeah, so my party, so we're launching today, the collection of short stories, Unpossible and Other Stories by Fairwood Press. And, we're going to have a happy hour because I'm too cheap to pay for an entire full night party. So we're just going to do a happy hour. So I'm working on comics and working on a new novel that's science fiction about drugs and God.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah, sounds like fun. We've got the Mongoliad coming out next year. And which will be essentially the paper version of the massive serial. And then there will be two more books shortly after that that will be set in the late 19th, early 20th century.
Oh, okay.
That will sort of extend the four-world universe by a couple hundred years.
I want to work on that one.
And then beyond that, we're now that we've broken out of the 13th century, we're looking at all sorts of lovely places within time that are begging to have interesting stories told. So we're starting to scope the bigger picture. So,
cool. Well, thank you both very much for joining us.
Thanks.
Thank you.